Unit 7, Boom and Bust, 1920 to 1941. Why it matters. After World War I, the United States enjoyed a time of prosperity and confidence. The decade of the 1920s saw rising stock prices and increased consumer spending. It also witnessed cultural innovations such as jazz music and motion pictures. At the end of the 1920s, however, several economic problems combined to trigger the Great Depression that began in 1929. Understanding the events of these decades will help you understand American society today. Chapter 20. The Jazz Age, 1921 to 1929. Why it matters. The 1920s was an era of rapid change and clashing values. Many Americans believed society was losing its traditional values, and they took action to preserve these values. Other Americans embraced new values associated with a freer lifestyle and the pursuit of individual goals. Writers and artists pursued distinctively American themes, and the Harlem Renaissance gave African Americans new pride. The impact today. The 1920s left permanent legacies to American culture. National celebrities in sports and film emerged. Jazz music became part of American culture. F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway wrote classics of American literature. Section 1. A Clash of Values. An American Story. In 1911, Alfred Levitt left a small town in Russia to immigrate to New York City. Like many immigrants before and since, he had big ambitions, despite his poor English and lack of education. He wanted to forget his Russian heritage and become a successful American. My conscious drive when I got here was to escape the rigors of poverty, to become somebody of importance. This I don't mean economically, but someone who can justify his presence on the planet. I wonder, who am I? What am I here for? At 17 years, the first question for me, though, was, what was I going to do? What will I become? I made up my mind, as young as I was, that I'm going to amount to something in the world, and I'm not going to continue being one of those who starve. Quoted in Centenarians, the story of the 20th century by the Americans who lived it. Levitt did indeed amount to something. A successful artist, he lived the rest of his life in New York City. 20 of his paintings are part of the permanent collection of the city's Metropolitan Museum of Art. Nativism resurges. As the 1920s opened, an economic recession, an influx of immigrants, and racial and cultural tensions combined to create an atmosphere of disillusionment and intolerance. The fear and prejudice many felt toward Germans and communists expanded to include all immigrants. This triggered a general rise in racism and in nativism, the desire to protect the interests of old-stock Americans against those of immigrants. During World War I, immigration to the United States had dropped sharply. By 1921, however, it had returned to pre-war levels, with the majority of immigrants at this time coming from Southern and Eastern Europe. Many Americans saw immigrants as a threat to stability and order. The arrival of millions of immigrants also seemed to pose a threat to the 4 million recently demobilized military men and women searching for work in an economy with soaring unemployment and rising prices. As the new immigrants, many of whom were unskilled workers, sought to enter the workforce and establish a foothold in American life, many of them encountered ethnic and religious prejudices. The experience of two Italian immigrants, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, exemplified the prejudices and fears of the period. The Sacco-Vanzetti case. Shortly after 3 p.m. on April 15, 1920, two men shot and killed two employees of the Slater and Morrill Shoe Company in South Braintree, Massachusetts, and robbed the company of its $15,000 payroll. Police subsequently arrested Nicola Sacco, a shoemaker, and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, a fish peddler. The Sacco and Vanzetti case created a furor as newspapers around the country revealed that the two immigrants were anarchists, or people who oppose all forms of government. They also discovered that Sacco owned a gun similar to the murder weapon, and that the bullets used in the murders matched those in Sacco's gun. Although no one at the time knew if Sacco and Vanzetti were guilty, many people leaped to that conclusion because the two men were Italian immigrants and anarchists. Others viewed the case as an example of prejudice against people based on their ethnic origin and political beliefs. On July 14, 1921, a jury found Sacco and Vanzetti guilty, and the judge sentenced them to death. Many Americans, caught up in the anti-foreign fever of the time, applauded the verdict and the penalty. Over the next 6 years, lawyers filed numerous appeals for a new trial, but all were denied. In April 1927, a special Massachusetts commission studied the case and upheld the verdict. 4 months later, on August 23, 1927, Sacco and Vanzetti were executed, proclaiming their innocence all the while. Pseudoscientific racism. Nativist and racist feelings in the 1920s were reinforced by the beliefs of the eugenics movement. Eugenics is a pseudoscience or false science that deals with improving hereditary traits. Developed in Europe in the early 1900s, eugenics emphasized that human inequalities were inherited and warned against breeding the unfit or inferior. Eugenics fueled the nativist arguments for the superiority of the original American stock, white Protestants of Northern European descent. Political, intellectual, and cultural figures like Woodrow Wilson and Henry Cabot Lodge embraced eugenics. By doing so, they lent authority to racist theories, which reinvigorated the nativist argument for strict immigration control. Return of the Ku Klux Klan. At the forefront of the movement to restrict immigration was the Ku Klux Klan, or KKK. The old KKK had flourished in the South after the Civil War and used threats and violence to intimidate newly freed African Americans. The new Klan had other targets as well: Catholics, Jews, immigrants, and other groups believed to represent un-American values. William J. Simmons founded the new Ku Klux Klan in Atlanta, Georgia in 1915. A former circuit-riding Methodist preacher, Simmons pledged to preserve America's white Protestant civilization. In the 1920s, Klan publicity claimed that the organization was fighting for Americanism. The Klan attracted few members until 1920, when Simmons hired public relations entrepreneurs Edward Young Clark and Elizabeth Tyler, paying them a commission of $8 of every $10 initiation fee for a new Klan recruit. Clark and Tyler divided the nation into regions and paid more than 1,000 salespeople to promote the Klan. As a result of their strategy, membership in the Ku Klux Klan exploded, reaching nearly 4 million by 1924 as it spread beyond the South and into northern cities. The Klan began to decline in the late 1920s, however, largely as a result of scandals and power struggles involving its leaders. Membership shrank, and politicians whom the Klan supported were voted out of office. The sharp reduction in immigrants due to new immigration laws further disabled the Klan, depriving it of a major issue. The Klan never again had a major impact on politics. Reading check. Explaining: why did many Americans oppose immigration after World War I? Controlling immigration. After World War I, American immigration policies changed in response to the post-war recession and nativist pleas to keep America American. Even big business, which previously favored unrestricted immigration as a source of cheap labor, now feared the new immigrants as radicals. In 1921, President Harding signed the Emergency Quota Act, which established a temporary quota system limiting immigration. According to this act, only 3% of the total number of people in any ethnic group already living in the United States, as indicated in the 1910 census, could be admitted in a single year. This theoretically restricted the number of immigrants from all countries, but in practice, it discriminated heavily against people from Southern and Eastern Europe. ethnic identity, and national origin thus determined admission to the United States. Henry Curran, the commissioner of Ellis Island from 1922 to 1926, commented on the heartbreak caused by the Emergency Quota Act. The hardest quota cases were those that separated families. When part of the family had been born in a country with a quota still open, while the other part had been born in a country whose quota was exhausted, the law let in the first part and deported the other part. Mothers were torn from children, husbands from wives. The law came down like a sword between them. Quoted in Ellis Island, Echoes from a Nation's Past. Government. The National Origins Act of 1924. In 1924, the National Origins Act made immigrant restriction a permanent policy. The law also tightened the quota system, setting quotas at 2% of each national group residing in the country in 1890. By moving back the year to 1890, an even larger proportion of the quotas were allotted to immigrants from northwestern Europe. A second part of the act, which took effect in 1929, replaced the 1924 quotas with a limit of 150,000 immigrants admitted per year. In addition, the percentage allotted to each nationality would now be based on the 1920 census. This resulted in northwestern European countries accounting for 87% of the total immigration quota. Hispanic immigration to the United States. The Immigration Acts of 1921 and 1924 reduced the available labor pool in the United States. While workers and unions rejoiced at the reduction in competition for jobs, employers desperately needed laborers for agriculture, mining, and railroad work. Mexican immigrants helped fill this need. The first wave of Mexican immigration to the United States followed the passage of the Newlands Reclamation Act of 1902, which provided funds for irrigation projects in the arid Southwest. Factory farms soon dominated the landscape, and they needed large numbers of agricultural laborers. By 1914, more than 70,000 Mexican immigrants had poured into the United States, many of them fleeing the terror and aftermath of the Mexican Revolution of 1910. A larger wave of immigration brought more than 600,000 Mexicans to the United States between 1914 and the end of the 1920s. The National Origins Act of 1924 exempted natives of the Western Hemisphere from the quota system. As the demand for cheap farm labor in California and the Southwest steadily increased, Mexican immigrants crossed the border in record numbers. Reading check. Explaining. How did Hispanic immigrants shape the national identity of the United States? The New Morality. Many groups that wanted to restrict immigration also wanted to preserve what they considered to be traditional values. They feared that a new morality was taking over the nation. Challenging traditional ways of seeing and thinking, the new morality glorified youth and personal freedom and influenced various aspects of American society. The New Morality. Ideals of the loving family and personal satisfaction, views popularized in magazines and other media, influenced popular views on relationships. As the loving and emotional aspects of marriage grew in importance, the ideas of romance, pleasure, and friendship became linked to successful marriages. Advice books in the 1920s dispensed such hints as, "Have lots of pleasure that both husband and wife enjoy," and above all, be good friends. Women in the workforce also began to define the new morality. Many single working-class women held jobs simply because they needed the wages for themselves or for their families. For some young single women, work was a way to break away from parental authority and establish a personal identity. Work also provided the wages that allowed women to participate in the consumer culture. Women who attended college in the 1920s often found support for their emerging sense of independence. Women's colleges in particular encouraged their students to pursue careers and to challenge traditional ideas about the nature of women and their role in society. The automobile also played a role in encouraging the new morality. The nation's youth loved cars because cars made them more independent and allowed them to escape the careful watch of their parents. Instead of socializing at home with the family, many youths could now use cars to seek new forms of entertainment with their friends and to find privacy. Women in the 1920s. Fashion took on a modern look in the 1920s as women bobbed or shortened their hair and wore flesh-colored silk stockings. It also emphasized the youthful appearance of glamorous stage and screen stars. In this new culture, the carefree, chic flapper played a prominent role. Though hardly typical of American women at the time, the flapper, a young, dramatic, stylish, and unconventional woman, personified women's changing behavior in the 1920s. The flapper smoked cigarettes, drank prohibited liquor, and dressed in attire considered too revealing by previous generations. While flappers pursued social freedoms, other women sought financial independence by entering the workforce, many of them as sales clerks, secretaries, or telephone operators. A few made contributions in science, medicine, law, or literature. In science, Florence Sabin's medical research led to a dramatic drop in death rates from tuberculosis. In literature, Edith Wharton received the Pulitzer Prize for her novel, The Age of Innocence. Public health nurse Margaret Sanger believed that the standard of living could be improved if families limited the number of children they had, founded the American Birth Control League in 1921. This organization became Planned Parenthood in the 1940s. In 1928, Margaret Mead, one of the first woman anthropologists, published the highly regarded study Coming of Age in Samoa, which described life in a Pacific Island culture. Reading check. Identifying. What political, social, and economic contributions did women make to American society in the 1920s? The fundamentalist movement. While many Americans embraced the new morality, millions more feared that the country was losing its traditional values. To these Americans, the modern consumer culture, relaxed ethics, and growing urbanism symbolized the nation's moral decline. Many of these people, especially those in small rural towns, responded by joining a religious movement known as fundamentalism, a name derived from a series of pamphlets titled The Fundamentals, published by oil millionaire Lyman Stewart. Fundamentalist beliefs. Meant to reassert the authority of the Bible, fundamentalism focused on defending the Protestant faith against ideas that implied that human beings derive their moral behavior from society and nature, not God. In particular, fundamentalists rejected Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, which said that human beings had developed from lower forms of life over the course of millions of years. Instead, they believed in creationism, the belief that God created the world as described in the Bible. Two popular evangelical preachers, Billy Sunday and Amy Semple McPherson, stirred fundamentalist passions by preaching traditional religious and moral values in very non-traditional ways. A former professional baseball player, Sunday drew huge crowds with his rapid-fire sermons and on-stage showmanship. McPherson conducted her revivals and faith healings in Los Angeles in a flamboyant theatrical style, using stage sets and costumes that expressed the themes of her highly emotional sermons. The Scopes Trial. Evolutionists and creationists eventually clashed in a historic trial. In 1925, Tennessee passed the Butler Act, which outlawed any teaching that denied the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and taught instead that man descended from a lower order of animals. The American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU, raised money to test the new law and asked John T. Scopes, a biology teacher in Dayton, Tennessee, if he would be willing to be arrested for teaching evolution to his high school class. Scopes agreed. He taught evolution and was subsequently arrested and put on trial. The trial took place in the summer of 1925. William Jennings Bryan, a three-time Democratic presidential candidate, was the prosecutor and represented the creationists. Clarence Darrow, one of the country's most celebrated trial lawyers, defended Scopes. After 8 days of trial, Scopes was found guilty and fined $100, although the conviction was later overturned on a technicality. Parts of the trial had been broadcast over the radio, and Darrow's blistering cross-examination of Bryan did little for the fundamentalist cause. Increasingly, fundamentalists found themselves isolated from mainstream Protestantism, and their commitment to political activism declined. Reading check. Explaining. What were the major beliefs of fundamentalists? Prohibition. The movement to ban alcohol had been building throughout the late 1800s. By the early 1900s, many progressives and traditionalists supported prohibition. Many people believed the prohibition of alcohol would help reduce unemployment, domestic violence, and poverty. Their support helped pass the 18th Amendment, which took effect on January 29, 1920. To try to enforce the amendment, Congress passed the National Prohibition Act, also known as the Volstead Act. Enforcing prohibition became the responsibility of the U.S. Treasury Department. Treasury agents had enforced federal tax laws for many years, but police powers, a government's power to control people and property in the interest of public safety, health, welfare, and morals, had generally been reserved for the state governments. The 18th Amendment granted federal and state governments the power to enforce prohibition, marking a dramatic increase in federal police powers. The Treasury Department's new prohibition unit struggled to enforce prohibition. During the 1920s, Treasury agents made more than 540,000 arrests, but Americans persisted in blatantly ignoring the law. People flocked to secret bars called speakeasies, where they could purchase alcohol. In New York City alone, an estimated 32,000 such bars sold liquor illegally. Liquor was also readily available in rural America, where bootlegging, the illegal production and distribution of liquor, was common. Organized crime specialized in supplying and often running these speakeasies, which popped up all over the country. The huge profits that could be made supplying liquor encouraged some people to become smugglers, bringing liquor into the United States from Canada and the Caribbean. Smuggling and the consumption of liquor by millions helped create an illegal billion-dollar industry for gangsters. More than 70 federal agents were killed while enforcing prohibition in the 1920s. Crime became big business, and some gangsters had enough money to corrupt local politicians. Al Capone, one of the most successful and violent gangsters of the era, had many police officers, judges, and other officials on his payroll. Capone dominated organized crime in Chicago, where he ran bootlegging and other criminal rackets. Finally, Elliot Ness, the leader of a special Treasury Department task force, brought Capone to justice. The battle to repeal prohibition began almost as soon as the 18th Amendment was ratified. Supporters of repeal associated prohibition with priggish fanaticism. The ratification of the 21st Amendment in 1933 repealed the 18th Amendment and ended federally mandated prohibition. It was a victory for the forces of modernism and a defeat for the supporters of traditional moral values. Reading check. Analyzing. Analyze the reasons for the adoption of the 18th Amendment. Critical thinking skill builder. Synthesizing information. Why learn this skill? The authors of this book gathered information from many sources to present a story on how the United States came about and how the country's people lived. To combine the information into a logical story, the authors used a process called synthesis. Being able to synthesize information can be a useful skill for you as a student when you need to gather data from several sources for a report or a presentation. Learning the skill. The skill of synthesizing involves combining and analyzing information gathered from separate sources or at different times to make logical connections. Follow these steps to synthesize information. Select important and relevant information. Analyze the information and build connections. Reinforce or modify the connections as you acquire new information. Suppose you need to write a research paper on the status of women in the 1920s. You would need to synthesize what you learned to inform others. You begin by detailing the ideas and information you already have about the status of women in the 1920s. A graphic organizer, such as the one on this page, could help categorize the facts. Then you would select an article about women in the 1920s, such as the following. In 1923, the National Woman's Party first proposed an Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution. This amendment stated that men and women shall have equal rights throughout the United States and every place subject to its jurisdiction. The National Women's Party pointed out that legislation discriminating against women existed in every state. Some progressive women reformers, however, opposed the goals of the National Woman's Party. These progressives favored protective legislation, which had brought shorter hours and better working conditions for many women. The efforts of the progressives helped defeat the Equal Rights Amendment. Women's status in the 1920s. Economic. Many more women worked in factories and other jobs outside the home. Social. Women had much more social freedom, including greater choices in clothing style and public behavior. Educational. Many women had a high school education, and more than ever were attending college. Practicing the skill. Use the graphic organizer and the passage on this page to answer the following questions. 1. What information is presented in the table? 2. What is the main idea of the passage? What information does the passage add to your knowledge of this topic? 3. By synthesizing the two sources and using what you know from reading section 1 of this chapter, what conclusions can you draw about the role of women in 1920s society? Applying the skill. Synthesizing information. Find two sources of information on the same topic and write a short report. In your report, answer these questions. What kinds of sources did you use, primary or secondary? What are the main ideas in these sources? How does each source add to your understanding of the topic? Do the sources support or contradict each other? Glencoe's Skill Builder Interactive Workbook CD-ROM Level 2 provides instruction and practice in key social studies skills. You're the historian. The Sacco Vanzetti case. On April 15, 1920, in South Braintree, Massachusetts, armed robbers murdered two factory employees during a payroll holdup. Police arrested two Italian immigrants and anarchists, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, as suspects. After a court found the two men guilty, defense attorneys fought for 6 years for a new trial. The attorneys believed the trial had shown signs of prejudice, intimidation, and dishonesty. Did Sacco and Vanzetti receive a fair trial, or were they victims of the troubled atmosphere in the United States at the time? You're the historian. Read the following excerpts from testimony and evidence, then complete the questions and activities that follow. From trial testimony. The defense produced several people who supported the defendant's alibis. When arrested, Nicola Sacco had been carrying a pistol. The prosecuting attorney questioned Captain Proctor, a Massachusetts State Police ballistics expert, about the gun. Question. Captain Proctor, have you an opinion as to whether bullet 3 was fired from the Colt automatic which is in evidence, Sacco's pistol? Answer. I have. Question. And what is your opinion? Answer. My opinion is that it is consistent with being fired by that pistol. Defense experts, however, testified that in their judgment, bullet 3 had not been fired from Sacco's gun. The defense called on Sacco to testify, which gave the prosecution an opportunity to ask Sacco about his political beliefs. Question. Did you say yesterday you love a free country? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Did you love this country in the month of May 1917? At this time, Sacco had gone to Mexico to escape military service. Answer. If you can, Mr. Katzman, if you give me that, I could explain. Question. There are two words you can use, Mr. Sacco, yes or no. Answer. Yes. Later. Question. What did you mean when you said yesterday you loved a free country? Answer. When I came to this country, I saw there was not what I was thinking before. I could see the best men, intelligent, education. They had been arrested and sent to prison and died in prison. And Debs, one of the great men in his country, he is in prison because he is a socialist. He wanted the laboring class to have better conditions, but they put him in prison. They want the working class to be low all the times. The jury returned a verdict of guilty. In the sentencing phase, Bartolomeo Vanzetti was asked to explain why he should not be sentenced to death. "I am suffering because I am a radical, and indeed I am a radical. I have suffered because I am an Italian, and indeed I am an Italian. I have suffered more for my family and for my beloved than for myself, but I am so convinced to be right that if you could execute me 2 times, and if I could be reborn 2 other times, I would live again to do what I have done already. You know I am innocent. That is the same words I pronounced 7 years ago. You condemn 2 innocent men. Comments on the case. The Sacco Vanzetti case aroused indignation among intellectuals from the 1920s on. They generally agreed that the 2 were found guilty because they were Italian radicals, not because there was clear evidence against them. However, 2 students of the case, Robert Hansen, a local historian, and Francis Russell, who wrote 2 books on the case, believe Sacco and Vanzetti received a fair trial. Russell cites James Graham, an attorney for Sacco. "We spent considerable time with him, Vanzetti, at the Plymouth County Jail as the case was drawing to a close. Toward the end of the discussion, Mr. Vahey said to Vanzetti, in substance, 'I can advise you as to what the district attorney may inquire about the effect of your failure to take the stand, but you are the one who has to make the decision as to whether you will testify or not.' Vanzetti replied, 'I don't think I can improve on the alibi which has been established. I had better not take the stand.'" Russell also reports that Carlo Tresca, an anarchist who had supported the 2 Italians, told friends that Sacco was guilty, Vanzetti innocent. Then Russell quotes a letter from labor writer Paul Jacobs. "I had a close friend, Anthony Ramuglia. One day he came to me and said he had a story he wanted me to write. The story was that when he was a young man around the anarchist movement in Boston, he had been approached by one of Sacco's witnesses for his alibi in the restaurant at lunch. My friend Tony agreed and evidently was carefully coached in what he was to say, when suddenly he remembered that on the day in question, he had actually been in jail in St. Louis, and so might obviously be found out as a perjurer. He told someone about this and was relieved of his responsibilities. I asked Tony whether he thought Sacco and Vanzetti were really guilty, and he replied in much the same way as you quote Tresca. Sacco could have done it, but Vanzetti was never capable of such a thing."